Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. Let's start with the only good news headline I have this week, which is that Good Omens, which was a series on Amazon Prime and I want to say the BBC somewhere in Great Britain, by Neil Gaiman, aired in 2019, was supposed to be a limited series, one and done. Shockingly, out of nowhere, got a second season renewal this week. So it's been 2 years, more than 2 years, since the series was on the air. I think it's been three or four since it was filmed. And they're getting ready to go into production on a second season, which will probably air sometime in, I would guess, maybe late 2022. So that was very surprising. I never watched it, but I know Neil Gaiman has his legions of fans. Hopefully that'll make some folks happy, because the rest of what was going on this week is a hot fucking garbage dumpster fire. Okay, so I reported last week on Drake Bell, who pled guilty in Ohio of having inappropriate communications with a minor. This week, we get Kyle Massey, who is a 29-year-old former Disney Channel star. He was on That's So Raven with Raven Simone, and then he got his own spinoff called Corey in the House, and he was also a runner-up on a season of Dancing with the Stars. Well, a couple of years ago, he was sued by the family of a young girl alleging that he seduced her and attempted to have sex and or molest her. And he, of course, at the time denied any wrongdoing. Well, this week he was charged formally with a felony. The actual charge is immoral communication with a minor. The girl was 13 when the alleged communication was supposed to have happened. And it's such a gross story. All of this, again, is alleged, but apparently he met this girl when she was 4 years old on like some social media group. And so this would, if he's 29 now and the girls, this would have been when he was like a young teen maybe. And it was like in this social media group, and this young girl was like, was speaking to him through her family. She wanted to be an actress, wanted some advice. So he started giving her some advice, and they had a years long friendship, mentorship. And then when the girl turned 13, he allegedly started texting her some lewd things and potentially some sexually explicit photographs, and tried to or implied that he would like to have some sexual intercourse type acts with her or something along those lines. And he's now being formally charged. So, like, good Lord, former child stars, the fuck are you doing? And then, speaking of awful sex crimes, to follow up on an episode from maybe 10 or so weeks ago, I mentioned that Bill Cosby was trying to overturn his conviction at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and I was not optimistic about his chances, but apparently I am fucking stupid, because Bill Cosby is out of jail, as I'm sure we all know after this week. So his conviction in Pennsylvania, which he was convicted to 3 to 10 years for sexual assault and aggravated indecent assault. And this was, I believe, only for one woman, but about 60 of them came forward and accused him of sexual assault and drugging and raping them for over the span of about 40 years. So from the 60s all the way to the mid-early aughts, he was accused of raping and sexually assaulting and drugging women. And he was sentenced, like I said, to 3 to 10 years in prison. And he's already served 3 years because he went to jail in September of 2018. So he served almost 3 years. Well, he appealed and it kept getting overturned, and it went to the Supreme Court, and it was overturned at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court And it is not because he is innocent, because he is not. I want to make that clear. He is not innocent. He admitted to at least one of these assaults, and that was actually the problem. So the reason this decision and conviction was overturned is because in February of 2005, the DA said in a press release that due to insufficient evidence rendering a conviction, quote, unattainable, the DA declined to authorize the filing of criminal charges against Cosby regarding allegations Andrea constantly made against him, which is what he was eventually convicted of. The DA said he did so to compel Cosby to testify in a civil lawsuit brought by Constand without the right to not incriminate himself, you know, a court, Fifth Amendment, blah, blah, blah. In this testimony, he said that he had given Andrea Constand Benadryl and he had separately provided Quaaludes to women he wanted to have sex with. So admitting freely to drugging these women before he had sex with them so that they were unconscious. In the civil lawsuit that he gave the testimony for, he paid $3.38 million. Now, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, 6 of the 7 Supreme Court justices, interpreted this press release as a promise not to prosecute Cosby, which is what he ended up being prosecuted and convicted of. So this, they said, was a violation of his civil rights because this was used as key evidence in his criminal trial. This is fucked up. It is fucked up. And I want to make clear that Bill Cosby is not innocent, because you will see women and men online who are saying that this is justice being served. Felicia Rashad was one of them who immediately after the conviction was overturned said something like a grievous right is being wrong is being righted, something like that. This man is not innocent. He admitted in at least the civil lawsuit to at least one case, specifically to Andrea Constand, of drugging and raping her. And he also admitted that, yes, he had given drugs to other women he wanted to have sex with, implying that they would then be unconscious when he had sex with them. So Bill Cosby is and will always be a rapist. Only he now gets to be a rapist in the comfort of his own home as a feeble, frail old man. And I, for one, am very upset and angry about this. Like, after he was released, his family and his attorney was like giving statements and saying stuff like, oh, Mr. Cosby is resting comfortably at home. He's having a nap right now and he'll join us later. And like, how fucking gross is it to think of, like, this man gets out of prison and the first thing he does is he gets to sleep in his own bed and he takes a nap when there are 60-something women who have had countless sleepless nights their entire lives because of shit that he did to them. And he gets to go in prison and say how happy he is to be home. A home where, by the way, he committed some of these sexual assaults. It's just really disturbing. And it felt especially horrible because when Cosby was convicted in 2018, it felt like such a watershed moment. Because as I'm sure a lot of people know, sexual assault is one of the hardest cases to try and convict in criminal court. Because so often, like something like 90%+ of the time, there is no evidence. It is so hard to get a conviction. You will notice it happen. Like, it's why so many survivors of sexual assault, I'm one of them, don't come forward and try to press charges. Because it is such a lack of evidence, and it is on the person who brings the charges to supply that evidence and build the case. And because in the case of sexual assault, that doesn't usually happen, because especially in, like with Bill Cosby, if he's drugging these women beforehand, their testimony then can be deemed, you know, inadmissible because they were not in the right state of mind. But that's the fucking point, is he put them in an altered state of mind. But then that works against you when you're testifying under oath. And that there's typically not a lot of evidence that, like, unless you are a virgin, and how do you prove virginity is, like, unless a rape kit was done and there is substantial damage, but and then they can say that that is likely the cause of rape, but there's no guarantee. Like, no doctor can say this was caused because of rape. That it just, it's so hard. And then anyone, like, if there's DNA evidence, they can argue that that it was consensual. And then it's your word against someone else's word. And who is typically believed is, if it's a case of a woman being raped, the man is typically believed, because that's just the fucking society that we live in. It's maddening. And Cosby was convicted, and he got an appropriate sentence, 3 to 10 years. And it felt so good. And then for something like this to happen is just, it's going to do so much more damage than I think a lot of people realize. This is going to discourage even more sexual assault victims to come forward. It's going to give prosecutors pause in going after rapists and sexual assailants. I don't know, and I'm just really grossed out. Like, between this and Kyle Massey and Drake Bell, and then in my recaps, I'm going to talk about the Top Chef finale. And surprise, surprise, the winner of that is currently embroiled in a sexual assault accusation as well. Like, keep your dicks in your fucking pants. It is not that hard to ask for consent. It's not that hard to text and sext people who are 18 or over. It is not that fucking hard to meet people who want to have sex with you on your own merits and without being under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So, like, this is gonna be a real fun episode. It's been a real fun week. I should probably put a trigger warning in the description. Woo! Happy 4th of July, everyone. Coming up this week on the podcast, I am recapping, like I said, the Top Chef finale and the accusations against the winner, Gabe Arelas. And also, for something a little lighter, the first of the Fear Street trilogy that is streaming on Netflix. So, yeah, sit back, because as you can tell from this intro, it's been a week. It's been a week. Let's start with the Top Chef finale. So I recapped on one of the early episodes of the podcast, the premiere, and I was high on this season. I still am. I think it was a really great season of Top Chef. Probably one of the best seasons of Top Chef. Certainly the best since, I'm going to say, pre-All-Stars. So Richard Blaze won the first All-Stars. I think that was season 8. So I'm going to say this was likely the best season of the show since those first 7 or 8 seasons. And it was, I want to say, like season 15 or something like that. So Top Chef really worked out the kinks of pandemic reality TV filming in a way that not a lot of other reality shows that I watch was able to. It made the chefs kind of go back to basics. Like, it didn't throw these ridiculously absurd challenges at them where they're like, you're gonna cook 4 courses for 500 people and you're gonna do it in 10 minutes. Good luck. Like, it wasn't any of that shit where they're catering for a huge event, where they're following like strict parameters and, you know, serving and doing restaurant wars in the way where, like, you know, they're trying to do 100 dinner services in an hour. It didn't have a lot of that chaos, and it really made the chefs go back to the food and the emotion behind the food and get creative with their cooking. And it was just overall a really successful season. It was a really good cast for the most part. The stakes were good. The Last Chance Kitchen returnees were good. It was overall a really entertaining and really successful season of TV, especially for a season of Top Chef. But then we get to this finale, and our top three are, in general and in every season, this would have been a really stellar top three. You have Shota and Dawn, who are by far the two fan favorites, and then you have Gabe, who is technically one of, if not the best chefs all season. And you have vastly different styles of cooking. You have Dawn, who does like homey but thoughtful and technical, American style Southern flair cooking. You have Shota, who is very traditional Japanese cooking, which is very technical and very precise, and has a million ingredients and steps, and it's complex but also simple. And then you have Gabe, who does very traditional Mexican and Latinx, Latino food. I don't know what the proper Hispanic cultural food, and like is a saucier and also very homey and simple, but done really well and in a different culture than Dawn's. So like it was a really well-rounded top three for the most part. And that is wonderful to see a top three where it's like, you know what? Any of these three could win and you can make a case for it. That doesn't happen a lot on reality TV. And I feel like on Top Chef, it doesn't tend to happen a lot because I feel like on Top Chef, you have a lot of like really great chefs who will get toward the end and make a huge fuck up and then like shoot their chances. Like I'm thinking about Gregory, where I think he made it to like top five and then was gone because he like forgot to salt something or something stupid like that. Like I feel like that happens a lot on Top Chef where the pressure gets to them toward the end, and like almost always we'll get one chef who gets almost to the finale and should be in the finale and then chokes. And then like what happens in this finale, we'll get chefs who get to the finale and then choke there. Richard Blaze is a great example of that from his original season. And unfortunately, that's what happens here with Dawn. We saw Dawn kind of like start slow, get a ton of momentum at the like toward the middle of the season, and then kind of start to peter off and make stupid mistakes. And that happened again here, where she just in the finale did not get all the food on the plate for one of her courses. So as always, the challenge is to make a progressive meal and make the best meal of your life, and it's four courses. And Dawn makes a dish. I forget which one it was, but like part of it didn't get on a couple of the plates. And this is the third or fourth time this has happened to her this season. And it's all been in the past few episodes where she's just not gotten everything on the plate. And until the finale, like the rest of her food has been enough to kind of get her through. And those who do get the element on the plate are able to, talk about how successful it was and all that shit. But in this case, it's the finale. Like, you can't put food on the plate and win. You can't miss putting food on the plate and still win Top Chef. So immediately we know that it's between Gabe and Shota. And Shota, like I said, has been a fan favorite the whole season. He's funny, he's fun, his confessionals are fun. He has that annoying but endearing laugh, the laugh. And he makes really technically precise and beautiful and delicious sounding food that like Gabe and Dawn make the kind of food, like I was saying, that's like homey and comforting. And it's the kind of food that like you could see yourself eating and making at home. Like you probably won't make it obviously as well as they do, but it's the kind of food that like you want to eat at your house and that you could like they could be adapted for like a cookbook or a Food Network show and that you could attempt yourself. Shota, I feel like, does not make that kind of food because it's all ingredients that I feel like I would never know where to or how to source. And like anytime a chef uses those giant tweezers in the kitchen, I'm like, okay, I could never make this. Whatever it is you're making, I could never do it. Even if it's just to place garnish. Like, because when I chop up herbs and stuff and sprinkle them on top, I wash them first, half of them stick to my finger, and then I'm just like flicking and throwing them at the plate to try to get them off, and they're going all over the kitchen. Like, I don't have time for tweezers. So if you're using tweezers, you're operating on a different level. And I don't know how to make your food. So for my money, Shota, with that fan favorite mentality, with the beautiful, delicious looking food, and with the technique that comes with the kind of food that he makes, I feel like is what we expect from a Top Chef. Whereas Gabe then kind of just elevates food that we think of as maybe common. You know, like his final course, there was like head cheese in it. And like that is, you know, for all intents and purposes, peasant food in a lot of places, right? You know, short ribs. He cooks with things like, you know, he did scallops in this episode. So he makes food that is common but elevated. Whereas like Shota did sashimi. Now, I don't know a single damn person who makes their own sashimi. And then he made octopus and beef tongue and a cheesecake with smoked gelato. Like, people are not smoking things in their house, let alone ice cream. Do you know what I'm saying? So I found Shota to be more, in my mind, deserving of winning Top Chef, but he did not, and Gabe is named Top Chef. Now, I think I mentioned in my recap of the premiere that I did not like Gabe from the jump. There was just something about him that annoyed me. Like, I know that he is at least part Mexican, so he did the, like, Jada De Laurentiis pronunciation of Mexican words. Like, you know how like on Jada's show she pronounces, and everyone makes fun of her for this, she pronounces Italian words like overly Italian, when she'll be like, and then we're going to take the mozzarella and we're going to mix it with the burrata. Like, it's just that she, the spaghetti, like it's spaghetti, bitch. You're in fucking California. Like, we get that you're Italian, but it's spaghetti. You're in America. Like, spaghetti, like the rigatoni, like, stop it. It's annoying. And Gabe would do the same shit, where he'd be like, well, for you, I have today a mole. I'm like, it's a mole. It's a mole. Just say mole. Just say mole. You know, like, that shit always annoys me. No matter who it is that, you know, like, it's like people when you go to, like, I don't know, Burger King, and you're ordering a croissant sandwich. Like, it is a breakfast sandwich on a croissant. And people are like, can I have a croissant sandwich? Like, or can I have it on a croissant? Like, stop it. It is not a croissant when it's from Burger King. It is a croissant when it is from Burger King. Do you know what I mean? So he would pronounce words like that. So that just already annoyed me. And there was like, I don't like his face. There's something about him I just did not like. Like, I did not like him. I never liked him. And you know what? I was justified, because it came out the day that he won that Top Chef, which was filmed in October. In December, he was fired from his position at the restaurant he worked at in Austin, Texas. And he was fired for violating their code of conduct. Now, his boss at this place, which was called the Commodore, said that Gabe was fired for violating the restaurant's policies against harassment of women. Now, Padma tweeted after the finale, like a few hours after, that Top Chef was filmed in October of last year, and we were not aware of the allegations now coming out about Gabe. This should be investigated, and the network should consider its best action. Now, first of all, it is 2020 when this was filmed. It is like season 14, 15, something like that. Why is Top Chef not filming multiple winners? I feel like on Drag Race, they do this every season, where to avoid spoilers, they film multiple endings. If it's a top three, they film all three people winning. And sometimes they even film ties. So in this case, when there are only three people, why are you not filming three winners? And then pick the winner live. Or pick the winner that night, but then don't tell anybody, and then just splice in who wins for the final edit. Why are we not doing that? Because that would give you options. Then when you find out that your winner is potentially sexually harassing employees at his restaurant, you can, like, I don't know, pick a different winner. Blows my mind. Anyway, so this is a huge mess. Because Padma also tweeted, "No one has alleged sexual harassment on the record or otherwise to Bravo or Top Chef, and we judges did not have any indication of inappropriate behavior from Gabe during his time on set." So, okay, this did not happen on the set of Top Chef, great. But then also, apparently Bravo knew that he was fired in December after the show wrapped, and they just didn't say anything at all, which is fucked. So the owner of this restaurant, the Commodore, is Philip Spear, and he said that Gabe was let go after, quote, repeated violations of our policies and for behavior in conflict with our values. So then the Austin, what the hell is the name of the newspaper there? The Austin Statesman, something like that. What's the name of the paper in Austin? I can't find it, but the paper in Austin that broke this story, the Austin American Statesman, talked to Gabe. Now, Gabe's publicist declined to comment, but he talked to the newspaper, the Austin American Statesman, and said that he was fired because he had a sexual relationship with a woman on his kitchen staff in the summer of 2020. And then when he came back from Top Chef in November, he cut her hours based on her performance. He admitted to communicating with her in an unprofessional manner. However, the owner of the restaurant, Philip Spear, said, "I do not deem the woman's work as sufficient reason for hours being cut." Meaning, Gabe fired this woman because he had a sexual relationship with her before he went on Top Chef, came back from Top Chef and was like, "Oh fuck, people are going to find out that I was cheating on my wife, whom I have three children with, and now I'm going to be on TV. And oh, by the way, I won, so I need to not look like a terrible asshole. So I'm going to fire you because I can't have you ruining my reputation." Then Philip Spear clarified to the Austin newspaper that Gabe was fired for, quote, repeated violations of the company's ethics policy as it relates to harassment of women. Dude, the fuck? The fuck? Now, this is like not new in the restaurant world. Like, we probably all have heard horror stories of chefs who are violent and angry and mean douchebags. And like, if you've ever read Anthony Bourdain's book, like they're all doing cocaine and fucking strippers and shit like that. And even some Top Chef folks have been caught in the crossfire. Like Paul, who won, like, I want to say almost 10 years ago, he was charged with assault after he beat up his girlfriend. Mike Isabella settled a lawsuit when a manager said that he was being harassed by him. So, like, this is not new. Look at fucking Mario Batali and all of his sexual harassment and his fucking sex dungeon. But come on, Top Chef. What the fuck? Shota was right there. So this just puts like a huge stain on what should have been and could have been a really great season of Top Chef. And now it's like, oh, this was such a good season, such a good cast, such good drama without being over the top and awful. And we really figured out COVID protocols to make everything work for everyone. But our winner like sexually harassed his staff. I was rooting for you, Top Chef. Let's end with something a little lighter, shall we? So, this past week, Netflix released the first of its three Fear Street films. Now, this is being marketed and sold as a trilogy of three films. And, I mean, I guess that is technically what it is. But the way that it's structured and being released, to me, feels more like a limited series. So I'm going to treat it as if it's a TV series because that's how it feels. So, I mean, like it's three really long episodes of TV, basically, because it's the three films are so intertwined. And like even the first one, basically, it ends on a cliffhanger like a TV show. And it, you know, like basically has a coming up next section, which you don't see in movies. So anyway, Fear Street is We all know Fear Street, right? Like, if you were born in the 80s or maybe even late 70s, you had to have read Fear Street when you were a kid or a teenager. I know I grew up reading R.L. Stine books, from Goosebumps to Fear Street, The Babysitter, which I thought was a Fear Street story until literally this week when I looked it up, was my favorite of R.L. Stine's. I think we are all very familiar with these, and if you're, but if you're not, Fear Street was a very long-running series of teen horror novels that came out in the early 90s and ran for, God, they're still going, actually, I think. It was just rebooted not long ago, and you know they're like sometimes supernatural, sometimes like murders. But they're always like really fun, really short, really fast. And I loved them when I was a kid. So I was really excited to hear about this adaptation. And it really made my heart even happier to see it because this first part is subtitled 1994 and it takes place in 1994. And it has so many nods to 90s horror and to iconic 90s things like the malls and the Scream movies. And this is very much in the vein of the Scream movies. So it, and like parts of it are shot for shot recreations of the opening scenes of Scream, which I love. It's so, there are some parts that are so campy and it's so nostalgic. Like, you know how a lot of people feel about Stranger Things, where like they watch it and like, oh my God, this makes me miss the 80s. That is what this series, or this first film, at least for me, did with the 90s, with like the neon lights in the mall. The first scene is an employee at a B. Dalton. And like, God, I miss B. Dalton and Walden Books. And I miss go. I used to go to the mall every month in the 90s to pick up the new Animorphs book. Every single month, first week of the month, I went to the B. Dalton to get the new Animorphs book. And if they didn't have it, I would check the Walden Books upstairs. And like that's how it was. And then the Everworld books, I did the same thing sometimes with the Fear Street and Goosebumps books. That's what we did in the 90s. So that made me real nostalgic. And then just the story in and of itself is super nostalgic because it like it kind of brings together so many elements of these books that I read in the 90s. So Fear Street is basically like the overarching plot, if you can call it that, is that like all of these stories take place in this same fictional town called Shadyside. And I believe in the movie, if not the books as well, this is in Ohio. And this town is cursed. Because way back during Puritan times and like Salem, like 1600s, there was a family, the Fear family, Feer, who allegedly were practicing witchcraft and were like burned at the stake and shit. So like the town is then cursed because of this hundreds of years old family that cursed the town. That storyline is in play in the film to a T, where like Sarah Feer is a witch who is like possessing people and making them commit murders. And it's all concentrated in this town of Shadyside. It does not extend beyond the town's borders. And this town is like total shit to live in. So many murders, so many unexplained things, like lots of poverty. And then the next town over is Sunnyvale, which is like one of the richest parts of the country and has, you know, great schools and all that shit. So in this town, the latest tragedy is this bookstore employee, Heather, is murdered, and so are a bunch of other employees by a friend of hers, and there's no indication of why this happened. And then a bunch of kids from Shadyside who knew her and other people who were killed go to a memorial in Sunnyvale. They get into a fight with some Sunnyvale students, drive their car off a road, and then we get this drama of the Shadyside student that we're following the most, Dina, used to date Sam, who was the new head cheerleader at Sunnyvale. She just moved from Shadyside to Sunnyvale. And Sam is closeted and is now dating a football player. And there's tension there between her and Dina. And then when they get into the car accident, Sam bleeds on the ground. And we later find out this is Sarah Fear's grave. So Sarah gets a taste of Sam's blood and once more. So she's coming after Sam. So she sends these undead killers to hunt Sam down and bring her more blood. And it's the kid who went on the mall rampage, a person who went on a murder spree in the 70s at a summer camp nearby, a milkman who killed a bunch of housewives in the 50s. And like all of these massacres that happened in Shadyside over the years, we find out were because of possessions by Sarah Fear. And she sends these people back to collect these kids that are protecting Sarah and bring her Sarah's blood. And like, it's super gory and it's so much fun. It's just, if you love a ridiculous over the top slasher flick, this is the movie for you. It is campy. There are some truly absurd moments. There are some brutal kills, which is one of the things that I loved about Fear Street when I was a kid, is like I was very mature for my age, no matter how old I was. Like, I taught myself how to read before kindergarten. I was reading like Animorphs and, you know, like RL5 books when I was in first grade. Like, I used to fucking read Danielle Steele novels when I was in like second grade. And that's not an exaggeration. I always read at a higher level. So I was reading these books that probably so how old are you in second grade? Maybe like 7 or 8. Like, I was reading books at 7 or 8 years old that were meant for kids who were like 14 to 16 or older. And Fear Street was some of them. And The Babysitter, which that book series fucking haunted me, The Babysitter. anyway, that reading these books, they were always much more violent and full of like gore and actual murder and death and stuff like that. Whereas like, you know, Goosebumps and things like that were just like kind of silly. You know, like there were aliens that looked like eggs or, you know, a plant monster that lived in a basement, you know, a camera that kills you, like dumb, silly stuff like that. That is great for kids. But like, when you think about it, when you get older, you're like, all right, this is fucking stupid. But Fear Street, I feel like, is not that. Fear Street is straight up horror. It's Stephen King, but it's, you know, simplistic writing and dialogue that reluctant readers and young readers can really get into. And this film really tapped into, I feel like, that feeling where it's like, you just want to have fun. This is horror that is scary, and there's the jump scares and there's gore, but also there's camp. Like, there is a, spoiler alert, a brutal death toward the end where they're in a convenience store and one of the characters gets pushed through a bread slicer. So this character's entire head gets sliced like a loaf of bread. And we see like the brains flying everywhere. It is brutally disgusting. And also, I laughed. Sorry if that makes me horrible, but also I laughed. And it's also very true to the spirit of Fear Street, where like the dialogue in these books was wretched. I mean, like reading it when you're a kid or a young teen or whatever, like it probably didn't seem like it was that bad. But if you go back and read these books now, or like go look up Goodreads reviews of some of these books, and people will put in like swaths of dialogue, and it's always just so terrible. You know, like it's all so expository of like, hi, Jeannie, I see that you're wearing a scrunchie and your short shorts. What do you think you're getting into today? Well, I don't know, Jen. I thought that maybe Brock might look at me if I was wearing these short shorts, and I have to go to cheerleading practice later anyway. That, like, it's all so ridiculous. And there are characters who talk like that in this movie, which is funny because you can tell they're doing it for camp value, not like just because that's how these kinds of books were written in the 90s. It's such a fun movie. The performances are actually all around pretty damn good. Olivia Welch, who was in Panic, which I recapped a few episodes ago on Amazon, she was really great on Panic. She's also really good on this. She has a great face. She plays Sam, the closeted cheerleader. Kiana Madeira is Dina. And like, that's also great about this, is that this is 100% queer horror. This makes no, it does not pull any punches. It makes no bones about the fact that this is gay as shit. Kiana and, or Adina and Sam make out. Their relationship is front and center. It is the impetus for the entire plot. It's great to see queer representation like this in a horror film. I mean, that's another reason that really touched my heart is because this is a movie that if it had been released in the 90s would have saved me like a lot of self-hatred and doubt. And I probably would have really latched onto it. Anyway, that's great. The performances are all on really fun. The music is fun. Like I said, there are moments that are shot for shot recreations of movies like Scream. There are references to the books, to there's prank calls like in The Wrong Number, which is my favorite, I think, of the Fear Street books. There are obviously references to the witches and to other paranormal things, which I think we might get into in the next couple of movies. But it's just, it's so much fun. It is so much fun. It's a little bit long. It does drag a little bit in the middle. But it's just, like, once you get to that climax of them figuring out how to, or trying to figure out how to get Sarah Fear from continuing to come after them. And then the finale where, you know, the aftermath of that is also super interesting and fun, and then ends on a cliffhanger. So it really makes you want to watch part two. And then part two flashes back to the 70s. The subtitle of that one is 1978, and that is going to primarily be about the summer camp murders. And then we, in part three, are going to go back to the very beginning with 1666, which I'm sure will tell Sarah Fear's story. So I highly recommend this first quote-unquote movie, although like I said, you can really treat this like a TV series, and it's escapist. It's just fun. Like, this is exactly what I want and need from summertime TV watching, is these Fear Street films. And the first one is streaming now on Netflix. The second one comes out this Friday, the 9th. And the third part comes out next Friday, the 16th. So strap yourselves in. Put on your scrunchie. Party line. Dial up. Three-way call your friends. And sit down to watch Fear Street. Relive your childhood, your teenage adolescence. I am already, like, I've already been online trying to find cheap used copies of some of my old favorite Fear Street books so I can go back and revisit them and just relax and let yourself have a little bit of fun, because as you could tell from everything I talked about this week, it was a fucking week and there was a lot of hard shit that happened, and I get it. So let yourself have some fun. Fear Street 1994 is currently streaming on Netflix. Get into it. Before I get into my recommendation and the schedule of the premieres and finales this week, I'm going to make a little announcement. So listenership has fallen off quite a bit in the past few weeks. I don't know why. I don't know if y'all are sick of hearing me talk, which is understandable. Or if we don't have the time. It's summer. Shit is reopening. I don't know. But regardless, that combined with the fact that not a whole lot of stuff is actually like on TV. And if I was, you know, just recapping stuff I'm watching, it would just be a RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars recap podcast, which I know some of you would be fine with, but, you know, that's not exactly what the purpose of this podcast is. So I'm going to take the summer off. And, you know, maybe I'll be back at some point during the summer, like if some crazy shit happens news-wise, or if like a really fucked up episode of something happens, you know, like I don't know when the All-Stars finale is, but maybe I'll come back to it, like talk about that. Or American Horror Story is coming back this summer, you'll talk about that. I don't know. But since there's not a whole lot to talk about, and since a whole lot of you are doing other things, that's totally cool. Let's take the summer off together. Just like the TV networks used to and the broadcast ones still do. So maybe I'll see you later this month in July. Maybe I'll see you in August. Maybe I'll see you back in September when the full fall season swings into gear. Who the fuck knows? But regardless is, do not expect new episodes every week, but stay subscribed. And then when I do come back, you'll know. Okay, well, with that in mind, coming up this week in terms of premieres and finales, again, it's a little bit of a dead time. On Wednesday, the second season of Dogs on Netflix, which is literally just a show on Netflix where they show dogs, and a new companion series, Cat People, are releasing on Netflix, and then new seasons of Big Brother and Love Island on CBS. On Thursday, this is one show I'm excited for, the reboot slash sequel to Gossip Girl. The first couple of episodes drop on Thursday on HBO Max. I'm really curious to see how the fuck Gossip Girl works in 2021, because that show was very much of its time of like everyone getting text alerts and Google alerts and a blog. But, you know, we've advanced quite a bit in terms of technology and social interaction via our phone since then. So I'm really curious about that one. Also, a lot of what the original Gossip Girl dealt with like traditional gender politics, that doesn't really exist very much anymore, particularly in New York City. So I'm curious how that one will go. HBO Max is also releasing a new batch of Looney Tunes cartoons, which those are really cute. You should be watching them. The fourth season of Grown-ish premieres on Freeform and the new summer season of Impractical Jokers. On Friday, Leverage Redemption, which is a sequel miniseries to the show from TNT that ended a while ago, is coming to IMDb TV, which I believe is just part of Amazon Prime. I don't really know why it's a separate thing. But yeah, that releases on Friday. Apple TV Plus is releasing more episodes of The Snoopy Show. Netflix has the fourth and final season of Atypical. Hulu has the second season of This Way Up. The third season of Virgin Ripper drops on Netflix as well, and Nickelodeon airs the first episode of the prequel spin-off series to SpongeBob SquarePants, The Patrick Star Show. On Saturday, Hallmark Channel is doing Christmas in July, and I am so excited for their newest Christmas movie, Crashing Through the Snow, which stars Amy Acker, who was on Person of Interest and will always and forever in my heart be Fred on Angel, and also was in a few other Hallmark Christmas movies, including the Nutcracker one from a couple of years ago. So that's on Saturday. I'm excited for that. I'm recording it and I'm going to watch it. And then on Sunday, the sixth season premiere of The Real Housewives of Potomac, which is by far the best installment in the entire Real Housewives franchise. And if you are not watching it, you're a racist. So you should be watching Real Housewives of Potomac. Also, the CW is airing a What We Do in the Shadows spinoff called Wellington Paranormal. And HBO has a new drama starting on Sunday called The White Lotus. And for finales, the second season of Card Sharks on ABC ends, as does the first season of Generation, which is still a fucking mess, on HBO Max. And since I am taking some time off, I thought I would just highlight some of the fun, cool stuff that's coming up this summer for you to keep an eye on. It's a lot of streaming, not a whole lot happening on traditional TV, cable, broadcast, and otherwise. Throughout the summer, it's typically a bit of a dumping ground for like game shows and bullshit. You know, like if you turn on ABC, it's going to be like To Tell the Truth, $100,000 Pyramid, Family Feud, The Celebrity Dating Game. CBS is going to be lots of Big Brother and Love Island. NBC is like American Ninja Warrior. ABC also has Holy Moly, that stupid ass Wipeout meets mini golf show. Like it's a lot of crap happening. So it's summer typically belongs to the streamers and to premium cable. And that's very true of this summer. So like some stuff coming up soon that I'm looking forward to. Catch and Kill, which is a series based on Ronan Farrow's book, Catch and Kill, from a few years ago about the Harvey Weinstein case and covering up sexual assault and abuse and rape in Hollywood. That starts on HBO on July 12th. On July 16th, FX on Hulu, so it'll be on Hulu, but it's through FX. We're getting American Horror Stories, what I talked about a few weeks ago. That is like an episodic anthology series, so each episode tells a new story. Peacock is releasing Dr. Death. Netflix has a limited series about Naomi Osaka, who is an amazing tennis player who is very prominently featured in the news lately. The second season of Never Have I Ever is releasing on Netflix. The second season of Making the Cut on Prime Video, which is the Heidi Klum, Tim Gunn show, which they left Project Runway to do, and it sucks, but maybe you'll like it. At least this first season did. Maybe the second season will be better. Who knows? Hulu has a limited series about Paul McCartney called McCartney 321. Netflix has this new show that was lighting up social media last week called Sexy Beast, which is like The Masked Singer, but for dating. So like you go on a date with someone and they're wearing this crazy ass over the top furry costume and you don't know what they look like. Apple TV Plus has the second season of Ted Lasso. HBO Max is releasing a new cartoon series based on Hanna-Barbera characters called Jellystone. Disney Plus is giving us a reboot of the Chip and Dale cartoons. We also get the second season of Outer Banks on Netflix. What else? Supergirl is returning for the remainder of its final season. Riverdale is finally coming back on August 11th. Brooklyn Nine-Nine comes back for its final season in August. The Walking Dead has its season 11 premiere in late August. We're getting a reboot of Fantasy Island on Fox in August. And the big thing that is all over the news and that we're all going to be talking about is the Olympics are finally happening on NBC. And whether you have positive or negative feelings toward them or some mixed feelings, like I think most of us probably do, especially after the Sha'Carri Richardson news of this week, then, you know, I plan on watching a lot of the Olympics. I always do. I love gymnastics. I love tennis. I love skeleton. Or is that winter? Maybe winter. Swimming, volleyball. I like it. So the Olympics are starting in late July. So there is some stuff still to keep your interest throughout the summer. My recommendation for the week also for you to watch, a quick one, is Dragging the Classics, which I mentioned on the last episode of the podcast. It is, now having watched it and laughed hysterically at it, it is a recreation of an episode of the Brady Bunch. It's the one where Jan buys a brunette wig because she's sick of being blonde and blending in with the rest of her sisters. And it is partially original Brady Bunch characters, partially RuPaul's Drag Race queens in drag playing these characters, and it is 100% absurd. So it's the episode, like I said, where Jan buys a brunette wig and Peter doesn't want to go to a party because a girl that likes him is going to be there and he doesn't like her. It's a ridiculous, it really highlights how simplistic and ridiculous the Brady Bunch was, which I think we all kind of realized after the Brady Bunch movies came out. But also it's just so funny to watch this episode with full-grown adults playing children, full-grown men playing child women, females. And Sonique, Kylie Sonique also plays Jan, which is ridiculous because it's wigs on top of wigs. And Kylie is like probably not one of the first people you think of when you think of like Drag Race actresses, but she's fucking hysterical. And like to see a trans woman playing a teenage girl is its own level of absurd. Fucking Candy Muse is Cindy. Like what? Shea Coulee is Marsha, and she does an imitation of Maureen McCormick's delivery. Like, well, Jan, I think that it came for, you can't blame me for having open mail. I thought it came for me. I'm the popular one. You know, like, and it's just so funny. And Barry Williams, who was Greg Brady, plays Mike Brady pitch perfectly. But the best part of all of this is, well, there's two parts. One is Bianca Del Rio playing Carol Brady is fucking hysterical because it is the antithesis of Bianca Del Rio. So that's funny in and of itself. Her delivery is hysterical. Her wig is hysterical. Her face is hysterical always, as we all know about Bianca. But it's also seeing Christopher Knight and Mike Lookinland play the same characters. So, so Christopher Knight plays Peter Brady, who he played as a child, and Mike Lookinland plays Bobby Brady, who he played as a child. Only they are now fully grown men wearing little itty-bitty wigs. And, like, to see Mike Lookinland act the way he did when he was like 7 or 8 years old, where like all he's doing is giggling and him and Chris Knight tickling each other. It is so beyond absurd. And it is so uncanny to watch because we know this is the same actor. We know it's 50 years later and they're doing this. It is just, it's crazy. And I could not stop laughing at how just ridiculous it is. I hope they do 100 more of these with CBS Viacom properties that are on Paramount Plus. Like, that's why they did the Brady Bunch, is because it's owned by this company. They also have on Paramount Plus, like, I Love Lucy. I would love to see an episode of I Love Lucy redone with RuPaul's Drag Race Queens. It's just, it is such a wholesomely insane way to spend 25 minutes of your day. I've already watched it twice, and it's been out for like 2 days. So I highly recommend it. Dragging the Classics, the Brady Bunch. It's streaming now on Paramount Plus. I feel like I'm a shill for Paramount Plus between like Salute Your Shorts and this and Drag Race All Stars, but like it really is. It's one of the services I'm using the most at the moment. Like, at the moment, the ones I'm using the most are HBO Max and Paramount Plus. So I recommend it. It starts at $5 a month. And if you get your free trial, make sure that you watch this before it expires. All right, everyone. I'll talk to you when I talk to you. Enjoy your summer. Watch some great TV. Feel free to tweet me and let me know what you are watching. Or, since I'm friends with most of you, text me if you want. I'm at Fake TV Critic on Twitter. You can always reach me there. And enjoy your summer. Get that vitamin D, bitch, and I will see you all in the fall. Have a good one, everyone.